The richer you get, the harder it is to manage your estate. There's lots of moving parts like portfolio diversity, tax mitigation, asset protection, and estate planning. That's why the ultra wealthy use family offices, and that's where Volarity Wealth comes in for you. Run by a former sovereign wealth fund manager, Volarity Wealth brings institutional level expertise to the high paid professional. Let Volarity quarterback your finances. Book your free consultation at VolarityWealth.com.
You are listening to the Wealth Formula Podcast with Buck Joffrey. Get ready to change your life.
Welcome, everybody. This is Buck Joffrey with the Wealth Formula Podcast coming to you from Montecito, California. And before we begin today, I want to remind you there is a website called wealthformula.com. And that is a website where you can get all sorts of resources associated with this podcast. And in addition to that, it's where you can join some of our email lists, including the Accredited Investor Club. Make sure you do that if you are interested in potentially deploying capital over the next year or so. I think there's going to be lots of opportunities, so I encourage you to go there. And after all, who doesn't want to join a club? So join the Investor Club at wealthformula.com. Now, today, we're going to talk a little bit about something that we talk a lot about on this show, which is taxes. You know, my friend Tom Wheelwright, who's the author of Tax-Free Wealth, known as one of the rich dad advisors to Robert Kiyosaki's, Robert Kiyosaki's CPA. He describes the U.S. tax code simply as a series of government-sponsored incentives, which I always thought was a great description. And as someone who hates paying taxes, this government incentive program has made me extraordinarily patriotic. I do exactly what the government says. The problem is that sometimes the incentives backfired, as we've heard in past shows with, you know, a guy from the Cato Institute telling us about all the errors, and Zolfi talking about that too, and transitory inflation, all that stuff. The government makes a lot of mistakes, right? So bottom line is those incentives, sometimes they backfire. Well, incentives historically have backfired when governments have tried to do it. Case in point, here's a good one. I like this story. During back a long time ago, the British were ruling India, and there was a proliferation of venomous cobras in Delhi. And to deal with this problem, the colonial government introduced a bounty and reward program where the people would be paid a cash amount for every dead cobra that they brought to the authorities. Now, initially, this seemed to work as intended. The cobra population started to decline because what happened was, well, people were, hell, they were hunting them and killing the snakes because they were going to earn the money and the reward, right? So the problem is that pretty soon people realized that they could sort of exploit the system by breeding and farming cobras specifically so that they could kill them and collect the reward. In fact, all of a sudden, there was all of these cobra breeding operations everywhere. And when the British officials discovered this unintended consequence of their bounty program, that is, people were now breeding more cobras than they were killing, they scrapped the reward program altogether. Now, this led to another unintended effect, which was, with no more reward money to be made, the cobra breeders simply released their now worthless snakes into the wild, causing the cobra population to proliferate even more than when the bounty was introduced. Now, as an American of Indian descent, I would love to tell you that these colonial British were just a bunch of idiots, but the reality is that the cobra effect is alive and well in the U.S. tax code. And to explain how, this week on Wealth Formula Podcast, I interview one of America's leading experts on tax policy, and he's going to tell us all the problems with tax incentives when we come back after these messages. Warren Buffett, BlackRock, and other institutional players dominate investments in commercial aviation. Why? Because it's one of the most profitable and predictable alternative assets that exists, and it's not tied to other markets such as real estate and the stock market. Is it safe? Well, imagine triple net leases to the likes of American Airlines and British Airways. Income is contractual and guaranteed by some of the biggest named airlines in the world. That's why this kind of investment was never available to the ordinary accredited investor. That is until now. Visit accesswealthaviation.com and check it out for yourself. Invest in an institutional team with over 200 plus years of combined investment experience in the aviation sector. conservative investing with double-digit returns and tax advantages. That's accesswealthaviation.com, accesswealthaviation.com. Welcome back to the show, everyone. Today, my guest on Wealth Formula Podcast is Scott Hodge. Scott is the president emeritus and the senior policy advisor at the Tax Foundation, which he led as president for over two decades between 2000 and 2022. He's also recognized as one of Washington's leading experts on tax policy, the federal budget, and government spending. He's the author of Taxocracy, What You Don't Know About Taxes and How They Rule Your Daily Life. Scott, thanks for joining us.
Oh, it's great to be with you, Buck. Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, this is great. You know, we talk a lot about taxes on this show. It tends to be a topic. We try to figure out ways where we can legally mitigate taxes and that sort of thing. But as you suggested, I think it's a hard topic to avoid in general. Let's talk about taxocracy. What is a taxocracy?
Well, it's a combination of two things that we, most of us at least, dread in our relationship with government. And that is taxes and bureaucracy. Mm-hmm. And in my mind, we live in a taxocracy. Yes. So many elements of our daily life are ruled by taxes. Mm-hmm. How we get our health care, determined by tax policy that was set in World War II. Real estate, those of you in real estate, taxes have influenced the design and functionality of buildings since the 1500s. From the window tax of Great Britain to some of the taxes that we see elsewhere, in like the mansard roofs in Paris. In many respects, tax policy determined the see-through buildings that we had during the 1980s, where people invested in empty buildings. Tax policy affects everyone today, and especially now as we're trying to encourage people to buy solar panels on their roof, electric cars, all manner of green technology, put their kids in daycare, take care of grandma. I mean, the list is endless. There are about 220 different tax cuts, deductions, exemptions, and so forth in the tax code. And each one of those, of course, has a constituency. And each one of those was put in place by politicians because they wanted us to do what they wanted us to do, not what we want to do.
Right. You know, my friend who's a CPA, Tom Wheelwright, who's a guy we have on the show a lot who talks about taxes and tax mitigation, has described taxes as most of the code is a series set of incentives by the government. Is that a fair description?
There are two types of incentives. There are incentives to get you to do something, purchase a home, save your money in a 401k, buy an electric car. And then there are the other types of incentives that are trying to discourage us from doing certain things, whether it's taxes on cigarettes to keep us from smoking, taxes on alcohol, taxes on wealth and income to basically redistribute income from the top to the bottom. So we have to think of this in a holistic way, that politicians are trying to both encourage us to do some things and discourage us to do other things, and basically use the tax code for both social and economic engineering.
Right, right. Right now, I guess, you know, the majority of Americans, apparently in polling, disapprove of the economy. How much of this do you think is influenced by the tax code?
I think it's a lot, to be honest with you. And especially now that we have a lot of the attitude toward punishing success and wealth creation, and, you know, attempting to use the tax code as sort of success taxes. I'm calling these, you know, sort of the new sin taxes, where it's taxes on wealth, raising the capital gains rate, higher taxes on personal income, raising taxes on businesses. All of these things are an attempt to use the tax code to essentially punish people for becoming successful, for investing and being successful, and essentially building wealth and improving the economy overall. And I think were we to move toward a simple tax system that doesn't punish wealth creation, doesn't punish investment and savings, we'd have a much more robust economy, and all of us would have a better standard of living at the end.
Yeah. So, you know, we have we have an election coming up.
Ah, yes.
I don't know if you knew about that, but yeah, there's an election coming up, and obviously, one of the big differences between these candidates, and just so people know, I'm not trying to get political, but I think this is just reality, and I think it's important since we have you here and you've studied this stuff more than gosh anybody else who's been on this show, and would be a good perspective on various types of tax issues and where the candidates land on those. I'm wondering if we can talk a little bit about that. The first thing is the global wealth tax. Can you describe what that is and what the position of President Biden on that is?
This is becoming a real serious issue that we need to pay attention to. And that is, there are some very, what I would call socialist economists at the Paris School of Economics that believe that wealth, that there's too much inequality in the world, and that wealthy people can hide their money or move their money too easily. And so in their mind, we need to have a global wealth tax that can be used, one, to reduce the amount of inequality, to prevent people from moving wealth around, and to raise money for all kinds of other purposes, mostly redistribution from the top to the bottom. A lot of problems with this wealth tax. And essentially, it's very similar to a proposal that Elizabeth Warren had a couple years ago, where she wanted to tax the 2% of someone's total wealth in any particular year. And she said, well, it's only 2%. Well, if your returns are only 4%, it ends up being a 50% income tax.
Right, right.
And the same guy that's designed this, the same economist, his name is Gabriel Zucman, is the one who designed Elizabeth Warren's wealth tax. And he wants to take this global. Now, Joe Biden has proposed a similar type of tax. It's not the same structure. It essentially would put a minimum tax on someone's both their income and their total wealth of 25%, but it has the same overall economic effect.
Can you explain that specifically? So if somebody, say, in our listenership, say they have a $5 million net worth and they make $500,000 a year, or how would that affect them?
So what you would do is you would essentially take whatever you paid in income taxes and look at that as a percentage of your total wealth. And so let's say if you're worth $100 million, and you paid $1 million in tax. Well, that's only 1%. And what they would say is you need to pay at least 25% of the combined income taxes versus what you should owe in terms of your total wealth.
So they would say you owe $25 million in that case?
Yes. Yes. This would be a huge hit on unrealized capital gains. And essentially, that's what they're trying to do, is tax unrealized capital gains on an annualized basis.
I guess from a global standpoint, it's hard to understand, but I think there's a spirit in America in general of seeing that as unfair. And I think it's probably in part because Americans are aspirational, right? You know, even if you are, not doing great right now, you see America as a place where you could get rich, and that could be you. To me, it just doesn't seem like something that would go over very well.
It's attractive to a very small segment of America, a very populist.
Like the Bernie Sanders crew, basically.
Yeah, but this goes back more than 100 years. In fact, the income tax was generated by those kinds of people in the late 1800s, early 1900s, who felt that, you had all of these wealthy industrialists and we needed to tax their income. And so this strain of populism has been with us for more than a century, and it's still there. And I think that it can be a very dangerous thing, because what they're essentially trying to do is punish success.
What would they need to do to pass something like that? I mean, just in terms of congressional support, I mean, it just seems like overwhelming. It's just likely.
Well, a lot of people, and a lot of lawyers and constitutional scholars will say something like that is probably unconstitutional.
Right.
And so they would have to change the Constitution. But, there are different ways that you could pass something like this. Instead of being an income tax, they could pass it as some sort of an excise tax on wealth.
Sure.
And so there might be ways that they could get around it.
Right. Okay. Well, let's talk about something that I guess, may be a lot more realistic, which is the stance on capital gains. What is President Biden's proposal on capital gains?
There are a couple different elements to what the president has been proposing, and this is not a new thing. This has been in his budget for the last couple of years. The first thing that he would do is raise the top personal income tax rate from 37% to 39.6%. He would then require people with more than $1 million in income to pay that top personal income tax rate on their capital gains. Currently, the capital gains rate is 20% plus the net investment tax, which is 3.8%. So what he would do is push the capital gains rate all the way up to not only 39.6%, but he would actually increase the net investment tax, which is from 3.8% up to 5%. So the capital gains rate, the federal capital gains rate for successful people would be well over 44%. And then when you add out on that to the state taxes, people in some states like California and New York, 50% on their capital gains.
Okay, let's talk about the death tax. Now, this is something that probably affects a percentage of my audience. Maybe you could start out by telling us what the death tax, what is it now, and what are the potential changes and proposals?
Yeah, currently, the estate tax is, 35% on incomes above, or on wealth, excuse me, on estates larger than about $11.5 million for a single person, $22 to $23 million for a married couple. Now, interestingly enough, the Biden administration has not proposed to increase that rate, which is, I think, a little unusual. But they do want to tax capital gains at death. So they want to get you both when you're living and then, of course, when you're passed away. Because again, what they don't like is unrealized capital gains, and they don't want you to take those unrealized gains and pass them on to your heirs, where they would get the what we call the step up in basis, where the value of that would be stepped up to the current rate.
And that affects not only those people who are, you know, at that 11 million plus threshold, but below that as well. If you have a $5 million estate and you have, you know, a couple million dollars in stocks, currently, there would be a step up in basis and your heirs would not have to pay any taxes on that money. You know, they would basically get reset, right? And and then in this situation, what would happen is this effectively, it would be like all that would be sold and you would have to pay taxes on that, whatever that percentage is.
Yeah, that's I think one of the biggest problems with the estate tax and any tax on unrealized gains is that they require people to sell off assets in order to pay for the tax. And what a lot of people don't realize is that wealthy people are often asset rich and cash poor.
Right.
You can think of the business owner, the farmer, so forth. Even if you have a lot of artwork, for instance, that's not the kind of cash that can pay a tax. And so what we have is a lot of evidence from economic history showing how wealthy people had to pay sell off assets in order to pay the tax. I have a story in Taxocracy about the heirs of Elena Sonnabend, who was a very famous art collector, and her kids had to sell off about $600 million worth of art to pay her estate taxes. Well, who were the buyers of that art? Three foreign billionaires. And so what the estate tax did was force the sale of these assets and the transfer of those assets into the hands of foreign billionaires. So effectively, the tax punished these wealthy people in the United States in order to enrich wealthy billionaires abroad. And that's what our tax model here at the Tax Foundation shows what would happen with Elizabeth Warren's wealth tax, is it would force many wealthy people to sell off assets. Foreign investors would swoop in and buy up those assets at a discount and transfer the ownership of those assets into foreign hands. And so, you know, there are unintended consequences to these taxes that are not fully realized by a lot of politicians.
So we talked about President Biden. What do we know about, I mean, I don't know how much of Trump's policy has been released as much as we just know what it was. What do we know about President Trump's policies with regard to some of the issues we've talked about in terms of comparing and contrasting?
the Trump camp has not been as transparent with some of their ideas for moving forward as we would like. The one proposal that's getting a lot of attention is his idea of imposing a 10% tariff on all imported goods. And that would amount to one of the largest tax increases in American history, about $300 billion a year in higher taxes, which in some respects would negate all of the benefits of the tax cuts that were passed in 2017. And in fact, when we modeled the benefits of the 2017 tax cuts, those were reduced by the tariffs that, that Trump put in place back in 2018 and 19. So we have to be very, very careful about the impact of these tax policies on other types of areas of the economy. Because, you know, what there are a lot of people who think, well, tariffs are great because you're taxing these foreign importers. Nope. The real tax is on American consumers and the companies that use imported products as inputs to their final products. And so there's a great deal of economic harm that can come from these types of tariffs.
Yeah. So effectively what you're saying is, okay, you're not getting taxed directly, but those taxes and the tariffs are effectively getting passed over to you because you're paying more. Those are not going to be absorbed by the producer or whoever's the retailer is selling you something. They are going to pass that over and you're going to pay more for it. That is a type of tax.
Yeah, and the taxes, the tariffs increases that they put on, say, imported steel and aluminum went right into the higher cost of the products, whether they were beer cans or nails and other sorts of finished products that were made here in the United States. Those importers or those manufacturers had to pass along those costs either to consumers or they had to eat those costs, and that impacted the amount of people that they were able to hire and keep on their workforce. And there was a great deal of economic impact and the loss of jobs because of those higher tariffs on imported products.
You know, I'm in Southern California here. I mean, luckily I'm not in Los Angeles. I'm a real estate, you know, person myself, and I'm sure you're aware of this 5% or it's 4%, 4 to 5.5% mansion tax, they call it in real estate. Maybe you could describe that, A, B, your thoughts on it. And I'm curious, is that even constitutional? I mean, it seems ridiculous. So tell the audience a little bit about that, because it's crazy.
Yeah, this is a transaction tax on the sale of homes over a certain amount. So the first rate would kick in on homes over $5 million. And then there would be a second rate on homes over $10 million. Well, this has caused a couple of different stupid effects. One is couples would split the ownership of their home into $2.5 million each so that they didn't end up paying the tax. And there were other ways in which people could avoid it. This was all predictable. If you go back in history and look at the history of these kinds of taxes, for instance, the window tax in the 1700s, 1800s in England, taxed windows as sort of a proxy for wealth, because the more windows you had, the wealthier you must be. Well, it was a graduated rate, so the more windows you had, the higher the rate. So what would people do to avoid it? They'd brick in windows in order to come below certain thresholds. Seem very similar things here with this mansion tax. The window tax ended up hurting poor people the most, because landlords ended up bricking up the windows of those tenements and apartment buildings. So the tax ended up becoming a tax on light and air, and caused a lot of disease within these tenements because they were so light and air restricted. There's so much history about the effects, the negative effects of tax policy on things like real estate and how people go to great extents in order to avoid it. And we're seeing it play out right there with that mansion tax in Los Angeles.
Yeah, and curiously, it's also actually it's on apartment buildings too. So like if you get, an apartment building in Los Angeles, you can't get anything less than 10, I mean, $20 million or something like right. that. But it's pretty remarkable, because to me, it's like, wow, I mean, you're just going to destroy that. What that means is that effectively, if you are selling a property for the same amount you bought it for, you'd be losing money on it. It is insane because it's a gross, it's a tax on the gross cost, the gross number. So,
and imagine, you know, a little old lady who's been living in a home for 30 years,
right,
you know, bought it for $100,000 and now it's worth, you know, $6 million. She's going to pay directly on that,
yep,
even though all she did was live in that home for a period of time. And so the sad thing is it's really a tax on the seller and it's not as much on the buyer.
Right.
And that's just one of the negatives of that kind of a tax.
What are some of the other influences of tax that we don't think about? I know you have talked a little bit about healthcare and college tuition. Do you want to talk a little bit about those?
Yeah, this is another area in which politicians have tried to incentivize us to do certain things like have the mortgage interest deduction that is intended to incentivize us to buy homes. We also have tax credits for higher education in order to make higher education more affordable. And what the research tends to show is both of those things don't work. The mortgage interest deduction actually raises the price of homes and makes them less affordable. Especially in urban areas where you have a lot of density and the price of homes tends to be higher to begin with. And because the deduction gets built into the price of the home, it actually can make the home less affordable and a higher price. The same thing goes with a lot of these tax credits for higher education, because the universities know that you as the student or the parent are going to get this, you know, a couple of $1,000s in tax credits. So they know that they can raise the tuition costs in order to absorb or capture that subsidy from the federal government. We've seen the same thing with electric cars, where automakers are pricing their cars in order to take advantage of that $7,500 tax credit that the buyer is going to get. So it's another instance of where the well-intended efforts to incentivize something gets captured by the sellers and raises the price of the good, making it actually less affordable and less attainable for poorer people than it otherwise would be.
Let's talk a little bit about, first of all, the tax foundation itself. Maybe tell us a little bit about that and then kind of the philosophy. And I guess in a perfect world, what would the tax foundation like to see?
The Tax Foundation is the nation's oldest tax policy research group. Our focus has always been on the economics of tax policy. And, you know, we leave sort of the technical issues to the lawyers and accountants. But our focus is on trying to move toward a tax system that does the least amount of harm to the economy as possible. We want what's called a neutral tax code, or one that just basically creates a level playing field so that we don't have to think about taxes. It doesn't affect our decision making on what to buy or what to sell and whatnot. We want a neutral tax code. We also want a tax code that's simple. It ought to be simple to comply with and simple to administer, anything what we don't have today. And you also want a tax code that's transparent. You know, you ought to be able to know why you're paying taxes, where the money's going, and how it's being used. And then lastly, we want a stable tax system, one that doesn't change a lot. Unfortunately, ours changes all the time. There's a lot of unpredictability in our tax system. Now, if you roll all those up and you use those as your guiding principles for creating a tax system, you're moving toward a tax system that's economically pro-growth, pro-investment. It doesn't punish savings and investment. It doesn't punish wealth creation. And it simply, effectively, taxes only our consumption. So it's moving us toward a consumption base rather than an income tax base. The result of that is more capital investment, higher productivity, better living standards, and a more robust economy.
That sounds wonderful to me. I would love to see it go in that direction, but it seems like we're moving in the opposite direction.
Yes. Sadly, both parties see the tax code as a tool to achieve their political ends. Most recently, of course, the Biden administration, when it passed the Inflation Reduction Act, was chock full with about 24 new and expanded tax credits and incentives to try to get us to do all everything from buying electric cars to invest in carbon capture. Prior to that, Republicans have done similar things with expanded child tax credits and other sorts of things, trying to use the tax code to achieve their political ends. And the only way to get from here to a neutral tax system is to somehow convince politicians that the IRS is not the right tool for achieving political and social ends. We have created a system now that the IRS cannot function, because it, what it's doing is it's a deliverer of benefits now. Mm-hmm. It's managing all of these different programs, from transportation to energy to healthcare to you name it, housing. All of these things is beyond the capability of a tax collection agency. And as a result, it simply can't function. Yeah. And so the only way to get from here to there is to convince politicians to leave the tax code alone. And let's move toward a system that is just simply simple and neutral and fair and honest.
Scott, the book is Taxocracy, What You Don't Know About Taxes and How They Rule Your Daily Life. A website for the Tax Foundation is simply taxfoundation.org. I want to thank you so much for being on Wealth Formula Podcast today.
Thanks, Buck. I really appreciate it.
Be right back. Self-storage is a necessary evil. It's where you keep your stuff and forget about it. No wonder this stuff is so profitable and recession resistant. The Wealth Formula community, well, we've benefited from that. We've made lots of money in this space with Reliant Real Estate, one of the largest self-storage companies in the country. With an average investor internal rate of return of almost 34%, with hold times just over 3.5 years, these guys know what the meaning of velocity of money is. If you're an accredited investor, make sure to check out what they're up to right now at ReliantFund4.com. Again, that's ReliantFund4.com. Welcome back to the show, everyone. Hope you enjoyed it. I always like talking about taxes. I like talking about how to mitigate them. And sometimes it's interesting to think about why they are designed the way they are. And this was a very nicely laid out by our guest today. Before we cut out here, I just want to remind you to head to wealthformula.com. Make sure you sign up for the Investor Club if you qualify. And also, make sure you follow us on social media. We're all over the place now. We are on Instagram. We're on TikTok. Facebook, obviously, we've always been there for a long time. And if you'd like to follow me personally, you can do that as well. Although I usually don't talk about business on mine. It's usually posting things like, you know, pictures of cool football stuff and things like that at buck.joffrey. That's it for me this week on Wealth Formula Podcast. This is Buck Joffrey signing off.
Thank you for listening to the Wealth Formula Podcast. Visit us on the web at wealthformula.com. The information contained in this podcast are opinions, not fact. As always, consult your own financial team before making any investment. See you next time.
What do the Rothschilds, the Romneys, and the billionaire hedge fund managers know that you don't about growing and protecting wealth? As you might imagine, the wealthy have a few tricks up their sleeves. One strategy allows you to grow wealth tax-free at a compounding rate with no volatility. It protects your money from creditors and lawsuits, and it lets you invest the same money in two different places at the same time. How about that for amplifying wealth? To learn more, go to wealthformulabanking.com. Again, that's wealthformulabanking.com.